So yeah, it's really great to be back and see everybody. Today I want to tell you about some research that actually started here while I was at PI. And it's published mostly in these three papers, although I do have a few newer results that I'm going to sort of weave into the slides a bit. And this is done, there's a bunch of co-authors on these papers. Actually, this one has like a dozen co-authors or something, because what happened was there were three groups who simultaneously had the same result and we just combined. But I just want to credit my principal co-authors are David Gross and Yikaila Yu, who are on, you know, they are co-authors on two different subsets of two of these things. So, first let me give just some background about why we care about quantum computers. I'm sure many of you know the answer to this, but I see some non-quantum people in the audience, so in case you don't pay attention, let me just tell you what the idea is. The idea is that we're going to take our theories of computation and base them on the laws of physics as we best understand them. Okay, and so, one might also want to incorporate general relativity at some point, but for now we're content to consider merely quantum computation, not, you know, quantum gravity computation, although maybe someday in the future. And the motivation comes from the fact that, the original motivation for the subject comes from the fact that we're able to get a lot of speed-ups at solving computational problems that are intractable in classical computers. The most famous example is probably integer factoring. This is Shor's algorithm. Also, unstructured search problems, this is known as Grover's algorithm. One can get a quadratic speedup for those problems. But actually, by now, we know many, many problems for which there are algorithmic speedups. Most of these, or many of these, have a sort of algebraic or a number theoretic flavor. But actually, there are several other tasks, primarily, so Feynman highlighted this in the 80s, that what are quantum computers good for? Well, they should be good for simulating other quantum systems. I mean, nature seems to simulate quantum systems all the time. So a quantum computer should be able to get efficient simulations of quantum systems. And also there's sort of non-computational things as well, which motivate our field. Things like quantum metrology. Can you increase the precision with which you can measure some unknown parameter like a magnetic field or a phase using quantum effects like entanglement or squeezing or things like this? Both of these, I think, are going to be really the main thrust of the field in the future. You see a lot of, occasionally you'll see people denouncing quantum computing as being useless because all of these problems are very specialized, but these tend to be computer scientists, and frankly, computer scientists aren't the ones that use computers. These are the main motivations for the field. And, what actually constitutes a quantum computer? Well, getting a scalable architecture is very challenging. It requires a lot of conditions to be met. For example, you need to have a well-defined qubit or a system with very well-defined energy levels. You have to be able to initialize the state. You need to be able to control this thing very precisely in some universal sense. You need to be able to perform measurements, and you need to have a lot of coherence, long T2 times. And this is sort of the Tao of quantum computing, that you require very strong and precise control, but you hope to isolate the coherence requirement. You hope to isolate this thing and have a very weak coupling to the environment. And this is very challenging. And so there are lots of proposals for how to build a quantum computer. And on this slide, I'm picking on one particular architecture, which is very promising at the moment, which is ion traps. So here we're trapping charged ions. That's redundant. We're trapping ions. And as you can see, so these aren't fully quantum experiments here in that they're not always coherent on long timescales, but we're talking dozens of ions at a time that are being trapped. And I don't think it will be too long before we're able to create very complex, highly entangled states of all these ions simultaneously. And this sort of begs the question, how do you check? How do you verify that your quantum computation is working as advertised? Okay? When you have full quantum computation, there is no order parameter like there would be. If you want to check that you have a magnet, below the critical temperature, you just measure the magnetization, right? And if you get some answer, then that's it. That is the signature, that's the experimental signature that you check to make sure that your experiment is working. But if I tell you I prepared the state psi, how do you check that? This is just an arbitrary state in Hilbert space. There is no local order parameter in general, okay? And as I said, you know, you can tell by the sort of the number of ions up here and the complexity of this device that, and if you just think about the exponential scaling of the Hilbert space, it's going to be very challenging indeed to try to verify an arbitrary quantum state is present in your lab. So that brings us to the sort of key challenge that I'm going to try to address today, which is how do you do this verification or, in general, characterization of these quantum devices? So there are lots of proposals for doing this, measuring things called entanglement witnesses, doing full tomography, which I'll say a little bit more about on the next slide, some other techniques like random benchmarking. If you don't know what these things are, it doesn't really matter. But in this talk, I'm going to try to get exponential improvements over many of these things, these previous attempts at addressing this problem. And in many cases, these are provably optimal. So that's the goal of this talk, is to try to find out what is the best you could possibly do and how do we achieve that. Okay, so let me just state what the problem with quantum state tomography is. I'm going to focus mostly on states in this talk, but almost everything that I say applies equally well to trying to verify or characterize quantum processes. But it's just simpler to focus on states. So the problem is we want to reconstruct a classical description of a quantum state given many single copy measurements together with classical post-processing. Okay, so you go into your lab and you run the experiment once, you get a copy of some unknown state row, and you get to make a measurement on it, and then that will destroy the state in general. So you run the experiment again, create a new copy of the state, measure it again, repeat this many times, and then your goal is to reconstruct a classical description of rho. So if rho is some state of n qubits, then your classical description will be a 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrix in the most general case, and that's the output. Okay, so we're trying to output something exponentially large. So when I say that I'm trying to get exponential speedups, I can't remove the exponential dimensionality entirely, but I can reduce it. And when you're faced with these exponentials, any little reduction is greatly welcome. So this exponentiality makes this problem a very difficult task for experimentalists. The record to date is, 14 qubits in a Schrodinger cat state. So this is like the all spins up plus all spins down, coherent superposition of those two. This was done by the Innsbruck group. And 2 to the 14 by 2 to the 14 matrix is awfully big. And to give a full characterization of an arbitrary state of 14 ions requires some huge number of measurements, huge number of observables that you'd have to measure. And in fact, the problem is worse than that. The parameters that you have to measure for a random quantum state are in general exponentially small, so you have to make exponentially many measurements. And then even then, as I said, to output the answer takes an exponential amount of time. Okay, so we're going to try to chip away at these towers of exponentials as best we can, find out what's optimal. Okay, so one thing that we're most interested in the quantum information community is preparing pure quantum states. Okay, so these are of interest, zero temperature ground states, or things that are most isolated from the environment. These are what pure states are. So just a simple parameter counting argument says a pure quantum state of a d-dimensional quantum system specified by d parameters, why should I bother measuring the d squared different observables that would fully characterize an arbitrary state? Parameter counting suggests that just d should be sufficient. So can we recover those parameters that describe this state efficiently and directly? And the answer is not in any obvious way. And there are lots of reasons why the obvious attempts fail. The most obvious one is computational complexity. It turns out that if you're parameterizing a state by a pure state rather than a density operator rho, then the equations are quadratic. And quadratic equations have a very different character. Simultaneous systems of quadratic equations have a very different character than those of linear equations. You just can't solve them the same way. If you try to do various optimization problems to try to find the solution, you run into barriers of computational complexity. The reconstruction of the state turns out to be an NP-hard problem. And also, it's not obvious which measurements to perform, right? If I give you some unknown quantum state, how do you know that the measurements that you're making are able to detect what those coefficients are? You need some scheme for how to choose what the right measurements are. Also, you don't want to put in the assumption that it's a pure state by hand, right? That's sort of cheating. You want your data to, you just want to have an estimator, which is hopefully unbiased or has some other nice statistical properties. You don't want to force the model, you don't want to force the data in sort of a Procrustean sense into some particular niche that it maybe it doesn't want to be in. Okay, so how can we surmount some of these problems? So let me just sketch what an ideal solution might look like in the case of an arbitrary pure quantum state, learning it as efficiently as possible. So what we would like to do is, if a state is close to a pure state in some particular sense, we'd like to get away with measuring order D observables. Okay? And we want this speed up to be generic. We don't want this to hold only on some subset of states, right? Because quantum computers were trying to really have the ability to prepare arbitrary states in Hilbert space. We want the measurements to be very simple. It sort of defeats the purpose to check the existence of a quantum computer if you need another quantum computer around just to make that measurement, right? So the measurements involved ought to be very simple. The cost function that we use, so the way that we find our answer, the way we produce our estimate, this should have nice properties, okay? In particular, it should be convex so that any local optimum, is also a global optimum. The runtime for the algorithm should be fast. So if I'm trying to output a full density operator, this requires d squared amount of time just to output the answer. But if I'm trying to output a pure state approximation, then I can get away in linear time. This is clearly impossible for dense methods. It should be robust. It should continue to work for all states, although maybe the speed up isn't manifest. And it should come with a certificate. So it shouldn't have to, the experimentalist who is actually using this technique shouldn't have to rely on a guess or a suspicion that it worked. It should come with a certificate that says, yes, indeed, this worked, and here's the proof. And it should come with rigorous error bounds, rigorous guarantees on the performance or confidence intervals, if you like. And it shouldn't make any assumptions about the unknown state, right? So this should be an algorithm which is output sensitive, but doesn't require the assumption ahead of time that the input state is, in fact, close to pure. The algorithm itself should be sensitive to that fact without assuming it, okay? So my first result that I'm going to tell you about satisfies everything on this list, nearly. It doesn't quite run in linear time, but it's close. And what it does is we take advantage of some recent work in the theory of classical signal processing and classical machine learning. Okay, there's been a bit of a revolution in recent years using something what's known as compressed sensing. So what is compressed sensing? I'm going to give kind of a cartoon picture of what that is. Suppose you buy a fancy digital camera, and you take a picture of something with your camera, and then you want to email this to all of your friends. So what do? Well, you take the picture, and then it's 10 megabytes in size or something, and you don't want to clog your friend's inbox. So what you do is you compress it. Oh, whoops. You compress the image down to like some 300 kilobyte JPEG image, and then you send that instead. And the fidelity of the compressed image is very high with the original 10 megabyte image. You've thrown away a lot of information that didn't actually matter for the fidelity of the image. Okay? That's the sort of traditional paradigm. You know, first sample, then compress. Okay? Compressed sensing says, well, if we're only going to actually use 300 kilobytes worth of data, then why are we sampling 10 megabytes worth? Okay? Why don't we just sample 300 kilobytes and use some cheap offline classical processing, which we had to use anyway in order to do the compression? That will save us many megapixels. Okay? So this has been a revolution not just in signal processing, but also in astrophysics, where people are trying to take advantage of very few photons that come into their telescope, things like this. So yeah, this is the main idea behind compressed sensing. So how does this work? Some of you may recall the Nyquist theorem, the Shannon-Nyquist sampling theorem, it's sometimes called. It says that if I have a signal which is bandwidth limited, and I sample it periodically at some particular rate, okay, then I need to sample it. In order to recover an arbitrary signal in this in the space of all functions, which are bandwidth limited with some maximum frequency omega max, I need to sample it this many times per second in order to reconstruct an arbitrary state, right? And that's just clear because, you know, if you gave me some set of points, I could take something and, you know, you give me some amplitudes that you've sampled at some intervals in time, I could just put an extra period of some, I could double the frequency relative to that, and then I could fit all of that data with some totally different function, and you would be guessing the wrong function, right? So this is sort of an obvious statement, and we seem to be getting around that using this compressed sensing. And the reason we're able to get around it is the following. So the idea is that in some particular basis, in the case of the image that I showed on the previous slide, this would be like the JPEG basis, okay? There's some particular basis in which the signal is sparse, okay? So you can just think of this as the Fourier domain. In the signal processing case, it's some wavelet basis or something, if you're familiar with these transformations, the JPEG transformation. So there's some basis, we're going to consider the Fourier basis, in which the signal is sparse, right? Another analogy is, you know, you have a piano player, and the piano has n keys, but the player only has 10 fingers, right? The signal is going to be sparse in the Fourier basis, okay? So how can we reconstruct just this compressed signal without worrying about, you know, all these other amplitudes are going to be zero? How can we just get those few amplitudes that we're interested in? So the idea is to access the signal only at a few random times, and then recover the Fourier coefficients by solving some underdetermined system of linear equations. Okay, so in general, if I present you with an underdetermined system of equations, of course, there's a continuum of solutions. So we have to pick one solution out of that subspace. The way that we choose our favorite solution is we try to choose the one which is sparsest. Okay? And it turns out that if you were able to do this, then this would give you exact recovery with very high probability over the choice of random times that you're making after sampling only S log omega max samples. Okay, so omega max is the bandwidth of the signal, S is the sparsity, it's the number of fingers on your piano player. And this is optimal because you need already log omega max bits just to specify what those frequencies are, right? So this is optimal. Okay, so if you could do this, as I just said, then you would have an optimal way to reconstruct sparse signals. Okay? Okay. Now, how do you find the sparsest solution consistent with some linear constraints? Okay? It turns out that this is, again, I mentioned computational complexity before. Turns out that's, again, an NP-hard problem. So what we do is we use what's called a convex relaxation. So rather than minimizing the sparsity of this function in some known basis, we minimize the sum of the absolute values. Okay? And this is a heuristic which provably works. Okay? So this is classical compressed sensing in like two slides, maybe three slides. Okay, we minimize this function, the sum of the absolute values in the Fourier basis, or in general in the basis in which the signal is sparse, given this underdetermined set of constraints. Okay, and this will succeed with very high probability. Yeah, question.
Can you say a little more? What do you mean by sparse in the Fourier basis? Is it like just a combination of a few frequencies, or?
Yeah, that's
more
right.
Subtle than that.
No, that's exactly right. So again, I think the right thing to have in mind is a piano with n keys has n different frequencies that you can play at, but you imagine a piano player only has 10 fingers, or in this case, S fingers. The sparsity is S. And you would like to be able to, you know, you would like to be able to figure out what notes the piano player is playing by measuring only very few samples of whatever he's playing. And so the optimal that you can do is you need to have log of the number of keys, just to even store the label for the key, times S the number of fingers that the guy has, right? So that's optimal. Does that answer your question?
So realistic images are sparse in this sense? Is that typical?
Yeah, so I mean, an example of this is the JPEG basis. The JPEG transformation is an example of this. It's not a Fourier transform. It's something slightly more complicated. It's like, I think it's a wavelet transform or maybe a curvelet transform. These are things that if you go to the electrical engineering department at University of Waterloo, people will be able to tell you about this stuff for days. These are just linear transformations in which it gives very good compression in practice. So, you know, I think the idea here is not that you can prove a priori that some given signal will be sparse in that basis, but people use this as a heuristic. They choose the basis in which they expect the signal to be sparse based on a heuristic, and then they run this. And one of the nice things about this is that if the signal happens to be sparse in that basis, it will compress the image, right? So this is what I meant by it's output sensitive without having to assume. So if you make a good guess and it is sparse in that JPEG basis, the algorithm is sensitive to that without you having to assume that. Okay, so all right. I've been talking a lot about a particular basis. Quantum information doesn't have a particular basis. Okay, states in Hilbert space, there is no preferred basis. Okay, so we need to remove the basis dependence on the theory of classical compressed sensing. Okay, we need a basis independent formalism in order to go beyond sort of classical commutative compressive sensing, go to this non-commutative and basis dependent case. Okay, so the way that we do this is we change our notion of sparsity. Rather than sparse in some fixed basis, we're going to choose sparse in the eigenbasis. Okay, that is, we want to study objects that have low rank. Okay, rank is going to be the natural object that we're trying to study here. And the natural convex relaxation of rank is known as a trace norm. So it's just the sum of the absolute values of the eigenvalues. Quantum states are always positive. So we're going to minimize the trace. Okay, we allow subnormalized density operators in this. Okay, so the analog to the first equation that I showed you, where we try to find some sparse solution consistent with the measurements that we've made, now we're going to try to find some low rank solution by using the trace as a proxy, which is consistent with some measurements that we made. Right. So I have some observables AK that I measure their expectation values. I get the value B sub K, and I want agreement there, and then I just find the least trace operator which is consistent with those expectation values. Okay, so this is the non-commutative generalization of compressed sensing. Okay, so let me tell you our results. Okay, the first result says the following, that if the measurements that I choose are just Pauli operators, okay, so we're always working in the setting of n quantum qubits, sorry. And so when I say Pauli's, I mean tensor products of Pauli's acting on each of the individual spins. Okay, so if I measure, so there's of course 4 to the n such Pauli strings, right? Or d is 2 to the n, right? So rather than measuring all d squared of them, I only need to measure r d log d, independent Pauli expectation values, and I will be able to recover an arbitrary state of rank r with high probability over a random choice of Pauli's. Okay, so this is, let me make sure I'm clear about what the quantifier is. I choose the Pauli measurements randomly, and it's with high probability over that random choice that I get a reconstruction, which is accurate for an arbitrary state, no matter what the state is. Okay, so then the first theorem that we prove is that this convex optimization has a unique solution as the accuracy of your data goes to zero. Okay. And this turns out to be optimal. We also have a lower bound. Okay. And some of the proof techniques that we use are, I think, quite interesting. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but we use something called a matrix-valued large deviation bound, which is originally due to Allsped and Winter. We have a novel technique for constructing a certificate. These convex optimization problems always come with a certificate. I briefly mentioned that before. We have a new method for constructing certificates. This is a big improvement over the previous techniques that people had been using in the classical community. I can say more about it if people are interested. Let me skip that. Okay, so let me say a little bit about, I had mentioned that we want these techniques to be robust to noise. I mean, you can't actually measure an expectation value exactly. You can only estimate it by gathering statistics, okay? So how many copies of the state, how many experiments do I need to perform in order to guarantee that my error is below some particular bound? Okay. So the next thing that we prove is that if the number of copies T is sufficiently large, okay, but no more than this, okay, this many copies suffices, then we can guarantee that the error in our reconstruction, okay, is bounded by some small amount. Okay, so let me unpack this expression a little bit. We solve this convex optimization here. And the solution to this convex optimization, which I'm calling X star, is close to the true state in the one norm. Okay, so this is like the harshest norm, I guess. And it's close up to this error epsilon, which features here in the number of copies, plus some additional error term, okay, which comes from the truncation error. What if the state does not actually have low rank? Okay, this is the projector, PR is the projector under the rank R, the first R principal eigenvectors of the state row. So this just says, what does the tail look like? If I have a state, let's say I have a Gibbs state at some temperature, right, then let's say it's below the spectral gap or something, then the eigenvectors or the eigenvalues of this thing are decaying exponentially. And so when I truncate the state, I will lose information about all of those, right? I can only get to keep the first R eigenvectors. So if I'm outputting a rank R state, obviously I can't do better than this approximation. So this term here is optimal up to this multiplicative constant. So this you can't make vanish for any fixed R unless the state itself has exactly rank R. And then this epsilon term, you can make that arbitrarily small. Okay? So this is an optimal error bound. Okay, you cannot do better than this. And now, how good is that? I told you that that number of states, that number of copies is sufficient. Okay, how good is that result? Okay, the next result that we have, this is one of the new results that I said hasn't been published yet. If we define the minimax risk, okay, so we just say, out of all possible estimation procedures, any estimation procedure at all that makes measurements on this quantum state, let's say two outcome measurements in the Pauli basis, okay, and I pick the worst case state, the one that does that my estimator performs worst on, okay, and I look at the probability over all the data that I take, okay, this is what I mean by the minimax risk, okay, and I don't want this minimax risk to grow, okay, I there's some risk, maximum risk at which I'm going to tolerate, as quantified by that expression. And if I want that risk to be bounded, then I need to choose some number of copies, which is at least r squared d squared over log d. Okay, so compare that with what I have up here, r squared d squared times log d. Okay, oh, I neglected the epsilon dependence, but it's the same. This is optimal up to log factors. Okay, so what we have is an optimal output-sensitive algorithm, which gets the optimal error bounds using the fewest number of measurements and the fewest number of experiments as well. Okay? So this is really an optimal algorithm up to some log factors, and we have a very good understanding of it now. So we also did a bunch of numerics. This graph, I guess just look at the blue and the red. Just the green and the black. I'm not going to talk about the blue and the red lines. It performs really well, even if I'm measuring some very few number of samples. This is like how many different measurements I perform, and this is the fidelity of the reconstruction, some measure. It performs really well. And now let me just show you, this is on real data now. So in 2005, there was an experiment done at the University of Innsbruck where they did full tomography of an 8-qubit quantum state. And they took a whole bunch of data and they ran some desktop machine for like, I think 2 weeks. I want to say 2 weeks, maybe it's only 1 week. And they ran it and ran it and ran it and they got some answer, and this was the output of their, this was the answer to their experiment. This was what they published in their Nature paper. And so now, I can't see, hold on one sec. So this is my code that I wrote in MATLAB, which runs on the same data. I'm just making measurements on the state that they reconstructed since I don't have the original data. And I'm running it right now on my MacBook Air. And it took them, I forget, 1 week or 2 weeks. And it takes me, OK, it's done. It takes me 18 seconds. And it outputs an answer. And I guess this is a little too small. But the fidelity between what I reconstructed and what they observed is 98.7%. Okay, so I've taken stuff that took them weeks to do, albeit in 2005. So you know, maybe my laptop is faster than their desktop by now. I don't actually know. But I've taken things that took a week on the timescale of a week, and I've brought it down to the timescale of a minute, okay? 30 seconds, something like that. So we're talking about really serious improvements. Okay. So this is sort of just the first part of the talk. I have two other results I want to talk about. So I've shown you this first procedure that I've shown you, which is this non-commutative compressed sensing. We get this square root speed up. It's provably optimal. We get optimal error bounds. It has all these nice properties, all the nice, the desiderata that I mentioned at the beginning. There's a few other open questions, which I'll just skip, because I want to tell you. So now the next part of my talk, I want to tell you about how can one learn a class of ansatz states. Okay, so oftentimes one is interested in specific families of states, such as ground states of local Hamiltonians. Okay. So suppose I give you a one-dimensional, strongly correlated quantum system, and it's cooled to, let's say there's a spectral gap, and I cool down to some very low temperature, right? Then we know from a large amount of theory that's been done in recent years that, in fact, this ground state will be well approximated by something called a matrix product state. Okay, I'll tell you what those are in a second. So can we actually, and these matrix product states are efficient descriptions of ground states of quantum many-body systems. So can we efficiently learn these efficient descriptions? Okay. So now I'm talking about an additional exponential speedup. Instead of things in terms of the Hilbert space dimension now, I'm trying to learn the state of n spins efficiently in n, okay, not in 2 to the n. All right. So this is yet another exponential lower. Okay. So what I'm going to sketch now is an algorithm for trying to learn ground states of interacting quantum spin chains, basically. Okay, so first let me describe what this ansatz class is. Okay, they're called matrix product states. It's a variational class, like I just said, and in some ways it's a systematic relaxation of the mean field approximation. Okay, and the way that you build one of these states is I sort of introduce a set of virtual degrees of freedom. Okay, so that's what these blue spheres are. Okay, these are virtual degrees of freedom. And this wavy line represents entanglement. Okay, so I'm going to parameterize the amount of entanglement between these virtual degrees of freedom by the dimension of one of these blue spheres, which is capital D. Okay, so this is a parameter for the ansatz class. When D is 1, we recover the mean field approximation. For larger and larger D, we are able to take into account more and more correlations. Okay, and what I'm going to do is, so this is that phi there is the initial state of my fictitious systems. And what I'm going to do is every time I have two of these guys, which are initially unentangled, I'm going to, wherever I put this dashed line here, I'm going to project from the two particle space here, I'm going to embed that, or I guess you could think of it this way, I'm going to embed a little d-dimensional system into that joint space. Okay, and if this embedding is entangled across those degrees of freedom, right, then if I just think of this as, I guess if you take sort of a dagger, you take this isometry and you treat it as a projection, right, then what that does is that entangles this guy with this guy now, right? The effective degree of freedom that I've projected out is now entangled. Okay, so this lets me get long-range entanglement. Okay, I mean it stops at some characteristic length scale, which is contingent on how large this parameter d is, right? But this is the idea, is that the entire class of states is parameterized by just these few numbers, right? These isometries which tell me how to embed this physical degree of freedom, or you know, my description, my, I don't know what to call it, this qubit that I'm writing down on paper versus these sort of virtual ones. This one represents the real physical spin, and these ones are just fictitious ones, right? So it's just these various tensors here which characterize the entire class, okay? And the number of parameters here is small, okay? It's exponentially fewer than the 2 to the n various parameters, or little d to the n parameters, which specify an arbitrary state in the Hilbert space, okay? So this is an efficient variational class. So now let me just give you some background about, so as I said, ground states can be described by these things. So if I give you some Hamiltonian with a spectral gap, then you can show that the ground state of that Hamiltonian is well described by a matrix product state in some particular sense. But also, given a matrix product state, you can construct a Hamiltonian for which it's the ground state, okay? So this is kind of a converse, okay? Given one of these things, I can always build a fake Hamiltonian for which it's the ground state. And this is what's called the parent Hamiltonian. And here's the construction. I take some number of spins, in this case 2, and I block these, I look at the reduced density operator on each of these little blocks, okay? And I call that reduced density operator rho j. And I look at rho j for, you know, all j from 1 to n. And then I'm going to look at the null space of this operator, okay? And then I'm going to build a Hamiltonian which adds an energy penalty to this null space, okay? So now the terms that are supported by that density operator, the eigenvectors that are supported by that density operator, are going to be annihilated by this Hamiltonian, right? So each of the reduced density operators is in the kernel of that local operator, okay? It gets annihilated. So we're adding an energy penalty to any of the unwanted correlations which are present, okay? So it turns out that under some suitable technical condition, which I don't want to get into, it turns out that the matrix product state is in fact the unique ground state of this parent Hamiltonian H that I've just written down, okay? Okay, so what we're going to do, in order for us to learn the state in this Ansatz class, this, remember, we have some strongly correlated spin chain, and we're going to learn the state from this Ansatz class. So what we're going to do is we're going to first measure all these reduced density operators, and we're going to get some accurate estimate, okay, accurate in the one norm, let's say, okay? And then we're going to build this fake Hamiltonian H, okay? Based on those estimates, we build our own fake H. And the ground state of this should be close to the true state. So if our estimates were close, we should have a very good estimate of this parent Hamiltonian. And intuitively then, the matrix product state, which is the ground state of this parent Hamiltonian, should be close to what the true state is. But how do we find it? So there are lots of ways to find it. Probably the easiest way to do it, although this doesn't come with rigorous certification, there are other ways that do, but is to use the density matrix renormalization group. So as I said, while this doesn't come with a rigorous guarantee, let me quote one of your colleagues, Guifre Vidal. He's not here, unfortunately. I would like to see his face. "I don't know of a single instance where DMRG has failed," he told me once. So this is a very good heuristic for finding ground states of one-dimensional systems. Although it is known that there do exist examples where DMRG does fail. But anyway, we can use heuristics as well as there are certain theorems which allow us to find matrix product ground states of Hamiltonians efficiently. Okay, let me skip over some of that. So let me review. Let me just very quickly review what I just said. So we get these local estimates, we build this fake parent Hamiltonian, and I can quantify, I'm going to skip this derivation actually. So let me skip the derivation. The bottom line is that I can reconstruct a matrix product state which has high overlap with the ground state. So the sort of infidelity between my matrix product estimate and the true state is bounded by some quantity, which is, there's some extensive error because I had to do this n times, and in the worst case, the errors add up. And this is sort of my accuracy, my statistical accuracy, how accurate my estimates were based on my statistics. C is a truncation parameter. It says, well, if my state actually was not a matrix product state, I must have made some truncation error when I tried to approximate it in the Sansatz class. And this is taking into account that truncation error again. And delta is the spectral gap of the parent Hamiltonian. Okay, so if I have a critical system with very long range correlations, right, I can't hope to learn anything about it from very local measurements. Right? So when the spectral gap is small, then my error gets very big. Okay? But when that spectral gap is constant, then you can make this error small. Okay. Okay. So that is,
what happens if you happen to learn a topological state where you do have an energy gap, but still locally?
Yes, that's a really good question.
You can't really distinguish between.
Very good question. So the technical condition that I skipped over is injectivity, right? And so the PEPS descriptions. So this would be in 2D, right? So first of all, in order to have topological order, you have to be in 2D, right? I mean, I suppose you can have like symmetry-protected topological order with like now you're on a fermion chains or something like this, right? But you would have to be in 2D. In 2D, we don't understand this parent Hamiltonian construction nearly as well. That's the first thing. But if you grant me, even if you were to grant me that, it doesn't necessarily satisfy injectivity, which is this property that the parent Hamiltonian has a unique ground state, right? So if you had a matrix product state description for each of the topological sectors in the ground space of this topologically ordered medium, whatever you have, then you could reduce your search space to finding what the state was within some two-dimensional space. There's a way to kind of use this to like bootstrap. You can like project down into that space and then kind of search. You will find some mixed state which is consistent, and then you can try to do tomography in that mixed space or something. It's ugly, but there's a way to do it. It's just kind of boring. Okay. Right. So, and you can extend this. So David Poulon's student is working on trying to extend this to critical systems as well, and learning the Mera Ansatz class that, again, Giffre were here, especially Giffre has worked on. Okay. Let me move on to the last thing that I wanted to talk about, which is something I call direct fidelity estimation. Okay. So the previous two slides, we were concerned with getting a complete description of a quantum state. Okay. But oftentimes, all you're interested in is just checking how well it worked. Okay. So I know what the target state is that I was trying to prepare in my experiment. And all I want to do is just check, did I succeed, or how well did I succeed? Okay, I just want to estimate the fidelity. That's one number, not a full description of the state. Can we measure that fidelity directly? Again, without cheating. We don't want to assume the presence of a quantum computer which can make arbitrary measurements. Then the problem becomes easy. Right? So we want to do this without assuming we can do sophisticated quantum operations. And the answer is yes. That's what I want to tell you about now. In fact, we can estimate the fidelity between an arbitrary state in the lab and its ideal pure state. You were trying to prepare some particular pure state. And we can do this using only a constant number of Pauli expectation values. Okay. So the idea is really simple. Suppose I have this state rho. And if I expand it in the Pauli basis, okay, the Pauli basis is an orthonormal operator basis. So if I expand it, I'm defining chi here is just this characteristic function. It's just the trace. It's just the Pauli expectation divided by this root d factor. Okay. Then the fidelity between some ideal pure state and some arbitrary state in my lab is just this overlap here. Okay. It's just this matrix element. Okay. But this is just an inner product between the two characteristic functions of rho and psi. Okay, so I'm just reinterpreting that trace as an inner product in the Pauli basis. But for a pure state psi, we know that trace psi squared is 1 if psi is a pure state. So that means that this is a probability distribution. Okay, the sum of the squares of these Pauli coefficients, suitably normalized, they sum to 1. Okay, so it's a probability distribution. So what we're going to do is reinterpret the fidelity as the expectation value of a random process. Okay, so what we do is we take, I'm going to take this sum and I'm going to multiply top and bottom by chi sub psi. And then I'm just going to collect the terms. Okay, so then I get a square here and a denominator here. This just looks like the expectation value of this operator where I choose this index j at random. Okay, I'm just reinterpreting the fidelity as the expectation value with respect to a random process. And then the idea is I want to sample this random variable x and then average over many trials. Okay. So by Chebyshev's inequality, the variance of this process is actually bounded. It's bounded by 1. So if I want to obtain an estimate of this fidelity just by averaging over some few number of samples, I can get an estimate which is accurate to within epsilon with very high probability using just 1 over epsilon squared different samples. Okay? And note this is independent of the dimension. Okay? All I need to do is pick that index 1 over epsilon squared different times, measure those Pauli expectation values. That will give me my answer, and it'll be accurate. Okay, there's a couple caveats with this. If it sounds too good to be true, it usually is. So let me tell you what the caveats are. The first is that sampling that index from that probability distribution is in general a hard computational task. Okay? So remember, the way that I got that probability distribution was by looking at the characteristic function of some quantum state. And in general, that's, you know, requires exponential descriptive complexity. Okay? So in order to sample from that probability distribution, that's a hard task. And the second caveat is that although I only need to measure 1 over epsilon squared Pauli expectation values, if I were to give you an arbitrary state or some random state in the Hilbert space, then the overlap with any one of those, any particular Pauli observable, is very small. And in order to resolve it away from 0, I need to perform a large number of measurements. In fact, I need to perform d measurements in a d-dimensional space. Okay? So there's two hidden dimensional factors here. The first one comes from sampling, and the second one comes from the fact that in the worst case, a random state has very little overlap with any Pauli expectation value. Okay? However, there's a lot of classes of states for which we can circumvent these nasty dimensional factors altogether, and they're very important classes. So let me, I want to leave some time for questions, so let me skip a couple of these things. Let me just mention, so there are large classes of states. I mentioned there are some states for which we can overcome this dimensional factor. So one such family of states are called stabilizer states. And I guess I'm going to say something about the why those are important in a minute. But let me also just say that we can prove that this procedure, even in the worst case, does better than the tomographic procedures that I mentioned earlier by a dimensional factor. Because remember, I had these lower bounds that scaled like d squared. Right? So if you're really concerned about how many resources you're using in your experiment, and you only care about measuring the fidelity, then you generically will get a speed up using this approach. So let me just highlight that. Just briefly, let me mention quantum channels. Okay, we can make all of these same statements as I alluded to at the beginning. Everything that I'm saying carries over to processes as well. If you have some ideal unitary quantum process that you're trying to implement, you can just sample inputs as well as measurements to the channel. So the way we do this is we just sample product eigenstates and put them into the channel. If this is a little technical, you can ask me about it later. We don't require any entangling gates. That's the point. Let me skip that. The last thing I want to mention is there's a large and important class of quantum circuits called Clifford circuits. Okay? And these are very important because in quantum error correction, most quantum error correction, so you know, we know that quantum computers are going to require a lot of error correction because they're very prone to error. And Clifford circuits, well, they're basically the discrete analogs of Gaussian operations, okay, on discrete states, okay? And those are all that's required to do error correction in discrete quantum systems. So they have a lot of algebraic structure, right? They have this sort of symplectic structure that you get in Gaussian operations, but again, in this discrete form. And for these, for this large and interesting class of channels, everything is exactly polynomial time. So if D-Wave in Vancouver contacts you and says, I just built a 100-qubit Clifford circuit, you could check the fidelity of that, of what they're actually doing with the ideal in a polynomial amount of time, polynomial in the number of qubits, not in the dimension of the Hilbert space. Okay. So that's the last thing. I'm sort of running out of time, so that's the last thing I just wanted to mention. So in summary, I told you about a few different ways that we can get exponentially fewer resources and learn, verify, or characterize the quantum states, these exotic, highly entangled quantum states in the lab. I told you about a non-commutative generalization of compressed sensing, how we can learn states in an ansatz class, which describes strongly correlated many-body systems, in particular in one dimension, and how we can directly estimate the fidelity using only very few resources. And I think that there's a lot more work to be done in the future on this. We don't understand the power of adaptive measurements, for example. We might be able to chip away even further at some of these exponentials if we're able to use adaptive protocols. Everything I mentioned is totally non-adaptive. And also, I can predict with certainty that in the future, people will use these techniques. And the reason I can do that is that tomorrow, up here tomorrow, a paper will be published in Nature where they use, they call it Monte Carlo process certification. But this is exactly the last thing that I told you about with these, with this, what I was calling direct fidelity estimation. So I'm really thrilled that people have paid attention to this and are already starting to use it, even if they're starting to use it tomorrow. So here you go, tomorrow's news today. Thank you very much.
Are there questions? So are there any topographic schemes that try to make use of the fidelity between sort of a fiducial set of states? So you can just choose, you know, try to figure out where you are in the state space by the closeness to a number of points.
So I mean, certainly you could use, you could just iterate this particular procedure over those points. But I don't know if that would tell you, I mean, all that would tell you is that you're this far from this point, you know, this far from point A, this far from point B, this far from point C.
Is there like a GPS for
state? Oh, you want to like triangulate it and then. There is something somewhat vaguely similar for special classes of states. So I mentioned stabilizer states. If you make certain Pauli measurements, you can sort of zero in on what the closest stabilizer state is, or you can declare there is no close stabilizer state. And you can do that very efficiently in polynomial time and polynomial measurements in the number of qubits. That's about the closest thing I can think of.
Doesn't regular tomography just kind of work that way, where
no,
you know,
not in polynomial time.
Well, it can't be in polynomial time. It's the number of states to uniquely
yes.
specify.
Sure.
So it's going to have to be at least depend on the dimension.
Right, but I think the idea would be maybe there's some nearby ansatz state which has an efficient description, and if you just were clever about sort of adapting your protocol and picking the right nearby states, maybe you could figure out what the correct ansatz state is. I mean, you can do exactly this for stabilizers. So, I mean, maybe there are other classes of states for which it's possible, I don't know. It's a good question.
I mean, if regular tomography could be thought of in that kind of way, it might be interesting to find out what the most efficient fidelity estimation schemes are connected to the optimal tomography scheme.
Hmm.
Okay.
Well, in the beginning, you mentioned something about applying quantum computers to ordinary, measurements in the more general sense, measuring magnetic fields or something like that. Can you say something more about that? What advantages do they bring?
Metrology.
Metrology.
So, if you have, if you want to measure, let's say you have a black box, okay, and inside this black box is some energy splitting between a ground state and a first excited state, okay, and you want to measure, you are able to time evolve a quantum system for some amount of time, and you want to use this to try to estimate how much phase has accumulated between. So, sorry, let me write an equation. I prepare this state, forget the normalization, and I evolve it for some amount of time t. Then I get some relative phase that accumulates after some known time t, right? Or I guess just e to the I theta, right? Theta is omega t. Right, and I want to try to estimate what that phase is. Okay, so what's the optimal strategy for doing that? So one thing you could do is just repeatedly send a single probe through this black box and measure. Right, so then you would have to turn this amplitude into a probability, and then you would have to sample from that probability distribution, and then that would enable you to try to reconstruct what this phase is. And you would say, well, you know, how does my optimal estimation procedure, how does it scale with the number of times I send a probe through this particular measuring device? And the answer is, well, everything I just said, the quantum mechanics was kind of just window dressing here. It's just like trying to flip a coin and guess its bias, right? I'm converging at this rate, okay? But if you're allowed to set up many of these experiments and send in an entangled quantum state in parallel, okay? If I send in this quantum state, a bunch of zeros plus a bunch of ones, okay, then the phase, the relative phase here, is going to accumulate n times faster. Okay? And if you're able to do this, you can all of a sudden get a much better, a much more accurate estimate using the same number of probes that you send through this measuring device. Okay, so this is what people mean by quantum metrology. Here, this is one thing that people mean by quantum metrology. Okay, so it's the fact that the use of entangled states allows you to estimate parameters more efficiently than you can do classically.
So the thing you're trying to measure has to be entanglable or something. I misunderstood. I thought like I wanted to measure a very weak magnetic field somewhere.
Well, you could put this in terms of a magnetic field, right? I mean.
But how do I entangle that many copies of that magnetic field with itself?
Well, if it's just a single magnetic field along the z direction, right, then there's some b, z, sigma z, right? Let's forget any x and y components, right? So this is some Hamiltonian that you have, right? And if I have a bunch of particles, j from 1 to n, right, then this is my total Hamiltonian, okay? Just the simplest thing you could possibly write down. Okay, this is some quantum system. I mean, it's a really boring Hamiltonian, but I could interact with this by sending an entangled state into some region which interacts via this Hamiltonian, pull the quantum state out after some time t, and then measure, right? And the point is that, you know, compared to sending in a product state, if I were to send in an entangled state, I could do much better in terms of estimating what this coefficient is, right? I mean, you agree that this will determine what the phase is, right? So it's equivalent to estimating this magnetic field in this case.
You entangle the probes, basically.
Exactly.
You you mentioned process tomography at the beginning, but said you would focus on the state case. Do you have results for process tomography as well along these lines?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, all the compressed sensing stuff works immediately for nearly unitary channels. Yeah. So a channel with Krauss rank R, which is a sum of, or well approximated by, R different Krauss operators, you can do all this same stuff. What you do is you measure Paulis at the output, and at the input, you randomly choose a Pauli operator, and you sample from the eigenbasis of that Pauli. And then the ensemble average of sending Pauli eigenstates through a channel, you have to do like a sign flip if you send a minus one eigenstate. But the ensemble average looks like you're feeding a Pauli operator through a channel and measuring a Pauli operator. And so you get to learn all of the Pauli coefficients of the channel in exactly the same way, and all the same, everything goes through. The fidelity estimation, same thing, everything goes through. For matrix product states, it's a little more complicated. Here, you would need a notion of like finitely correlated in time. I forget what these are called. I want to say they're called memory channels. And these are, it's kind of like a Markov type condition, or like a K-step Markov type condition. And this is far less obvious that it works, and I don't have any theorems or anything. I'm sure it can be made to work. Let me just put a big caveat and say it can probably be done, but I don't know any specifics about how to do it. Yeah.
So some people work on a paradigm for computing that's measurement-based. I think it's called measurement-based.
Yeah.
I mean, are these techniques useful in that?
Well,
yes.
I mean, certainly I can think immediately of one way in which they'd be useful. So the sort of canonical state which is useful for measurement-based quantum computation is called a cluster state. And it is an example of this class of states that I call stabilizer states. So one consequence of this work is that if you make the claim that you just prepared an n-qubit cluster state for some large value of n, then in an amount of time which is polynomial in n, in the number of spins, right, I can certify that claim or debunk it. Right? I can exactly compute the fidelity between the ideal cluster state and the thing that you presented me with. I can do that in polynomial time. I'd say for all the other known examples of what are called universal resource states involve matrix product states, it turns out. So you could use those matrix product state ideas to try to estimate the fidelity for those resources. So this is immediately applicable to that stuff. Yeah.
So following up on that, I mean, if the number of qubits is very large,
yeah,
it's unlikely that you really prepared anything with very high fidelity to a cluster state. What's maybe more plausible is that you made this n qubit cluster state, except that one or two qubits are wrong.
Mm.
So that will have very low fidelity to the pure perfect cluster state, but is still in some sense close to the cluster state.
Yeah.
Do you have some way of estimating fidelity to that subspace?
Yeah, I haven't thought about that at all. That's an interesting question. Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I haven't thought about that.
I just want to come back to Lucy's question and ask, what's the intuition that makes you think that you'll be able to do efficient tomography on some class of Markov chain-like channels? So what I would have guessed about the first case, states and processes, is that you're just using the Choi-Jean-Lukowski isomorphism.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got a scheme for tomography on n qubits, well, like you have a scheme for 2n, and you just add a channel on the n, and
mm-hmm.
you do tomography on the 2n. But if you have a class of states and a class of, I guess, if you have a class of channels in mind, you need a class of states that are isomorphic to those channels that you also have a
category. Oh, yeah, I see. So that's exactly what the question is, I guess, is are the K-step memory channels, or whatever they're called, actually isomorphic to matrix product states? And I don't know. I mean, they certainly have the right flavor, but I don't have, I mean, I, maybe I didn't put enough uncertainty in my original answer.
Yeah, I think like you have monogamy of entanglement across three systems, but you don't have monogamy of correlation across three times. So I'm sort of skeptical of the existence of an isomorphism. But maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I think it's a research problem.
Okay, that seems like it, so let's thank Stevie.